The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia, and thank you so much for joining us. I'm Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to be here. A senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, Matthew Continetti works in the field of American political thought and history. His books include The Persecution of Sarah Palin, How the Media Elite Tried to Bring Down a Rising Star, and The K Street Gang, The Rise and Fall of the Republican Machine. He is the founding editor of the Washington Free Beacon, the former opinion editor at the Weekly Standard, and currently a contributing editor at National Review and a columnist for Commentary Magazine. In his new book, The Right, he provides a survey of the U.S. conservative movement's evolution and intellectual history. Tonight, he'll be joined in conversation with Ramesh Panuru, the editor of National Review, a columnist for Bloomberg View, and the author of The Party of Death. Thank you both so much for being here. The screen is all yours.
You're welcome, and thank you for that introduction. I have been immersed, as you know, Matthew, in your book, and I'm delighted to see that it's gotten such a positive reception in so many places. But I want to start off our conversation by asking you to defend what seems to me a pretty misleading title, The Right, when, if anything, your book ends up suggesting, or really suggests from its very first pages, that there are multiple rights and that they are sometimes in conflict.
Absolutely. Thank you, Ramesh, and thank you to the Philly Free Library. I'm happy to defend the title and the use of the definite article by referencing my subtitle, which is The 100-Year War for American Conservatism. So what do I mean by the right, by American conservatism, and by the war for it? Well, it struck me while researching and writing this book that even the American conservative movement that you and I are a part of is one formation in amidst a much larger category of the right, which is comprised of figures, groups, and institutions that are united in their opposition to the left, but who might not actually share all that much in common. When I say American conservatism, I really am referring to the movement conservatism, which had its origins after the Second World War, and which really orients itself around a defense of the American political tradition, and in particular, the principles and institutions of the American founding, also known as constitutional conservatism. But in truth, that is only one variety one encounters on the right. And there are several other rights, whether they are more populist in tone, whether they reject the American founding and look toward Europe for political guidance. And so the book is called The Right because I wanted to show first that this broad universe exists. And two, I wanted to tell the story of at times cooperation between the various groups and at other times conflict.
So it's interesting that you talk about the conservative movement starting in the 1950s, or after World War II at least, and that is the typical self-presentation of conservatives when, you know, when we're giving the after dinner party talk about the history of the conservative movement. But your book actually starts in the 1920s rather than in the 1950s. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about why you made that choice.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd be happy to. Well, the first reason I made the decision to begin the book in the 1920s was I wanted to provide a sense of what conservatives thought they were defending. And in order to do that, I needed to begin before the moment in politics where the right began to think of itself as conservative, that is, as conserving inherited institutions. So there are many types of conservatives. Almost all of them want to preserve or conserve or defend something inherited, some type of institution that was passed on to them. In the American context, the conservatives really begin thinking of themselves as conservatives in the 1930s after Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. And so I wanted to show in the 1920s how the American right at that time was very self-confident. It didn't even think of itself as particularly conservative. It thought of itself as normal, or standing for normalcy, as Warren Harding put it, or standing for Americanism, as both Harding and his successor Calvin Coolidge often referred to. It was after 1932 and Franklin Roosevelt's election as president and the changes in the size and scope of the federal government that accompanied the New Deal that the American right began to think of itself as conservative, that is, trying to conserve the pre-New Deal dispensation. And so I needed to show a little bit about how that transformation took place. The other reason I wanted to talk about the 1920s and carry the story through the 2020s was that when you have this broader view, there are some political resemblances between the Republican Party of Calvin Coolidge and the Republican Party of Donald Trump. Now, Calvin Coolidge and Donald Trump are not alike personally, very different people, different backgrounds, different temperaments. But the Republican Party that they both led actually shared a few things in common. Both Republican parties were very skeptical of foreign intervention and wary of entanglement overseas, particularly in Europe. Both Republican parties were very cautious toward involvement in the global economy, wanted to insulate America from competition, in Trump's case, competition from China in particular. And both Republican parties were very skeptical toward immigration, Harding and Coolidge essentially signing bills that cut off immigration to the United States for four decades. Donald Trump focusing primarily on the border and illegal immigration, but you can also see in his Republican Party broader efforts to reform immigration laws, change the nature of immigration to the United States, and reduce legal immigration as well. So those are the two reasons I begin in the 1920s. One, to show exactly what the revolution was that conservatives were responding to, and that being the revolution of 1932. And then to illuminate some of the similarities between the Republican Party then and the Republican Party now.
So the populist and elitist strains within conservatism that you point out have waxed and waned at different times in the history of conservatism. How do you situate Reagan in that story? It's, Reagan certainly, again, to contrast your or compare your book to other conservative tellings of this history, Reagan is often sort of seen as the peak, that sort of everything before conservatism, everything before Reagan and conservatism is a working up to him. And then everything afterwards is a kind of falling away from him. What's your view of the extent to which he was an elite conservative and the extent to which he reflected a more populist conservatism?
Absolutely. Well, a third reason to begin the story in the 1920s and to tell the history of the American right over the last century is to turn Reagan not to the standard by which all conservatism is judged, as you put it, kind of either leading up to or falling away from, but actually portray him as one character in a cast that has many hundreds of characters. When you broaden the scope of the investigation, Reagan's role, while still significant, is slightly diminished. And in fact, that's not necessarily a bad thing for him, because it makes all of his attributes and capacities and skills all the more unique in my story. What do I mean by that? Well, looking at it through this frame of intellectual or conservative or Republican Party elites, often in conflict or cooperation with the populist grassroots, Reagan is really one of the most successful figures in this history at synthesizing the two approaches. So one of the reasons I think he could do this was that Reagan had his own political identity, which actually preceded his entry into conservative politics. Ronald Reagan voted for FDR 4 times, right? He was a Democrat while he was the president of the Screen Actors Guild fighting the communists in Hollywood, as he would say. Even at that time, he had a very positive view of the individual. For him, individual freedom was the necessary condition of individual flourishing. And even when he was a Democrat, he resisted attempts from government or from totalitarians to squelch human potential and limit the individual. And that's something he carried on through with him as he entered conservative politics and Republican politics in the 1960s. So he had his own set of principles, and he was also tied to the conservative movement. So that meant that he had relationships with the founder of your publication, William F. Buckley Jr. He had relationships with Barry Goldwater, the senator from Arizona and the Republican standard bearer for much of the 1960s and 50s. But it also meant that he had a connection to the populist grassroots. Part of that connection was simply his own political talent. He had political skills that enabled him basically to appeal to every section of the coalition. Every part of that coalition saw in him what they wanted to see. In some ways, very similar to the role that Barack Obama played later with the Democratic coalition, right? As an ecumenical figure, Reagan had that ability. But Reagan also was a savvy politician, and he understood how to elevate issues that would put him on the side of the grassroots populists. Most controversially, in the middle of the 1970s, he opposed the Panama Canal treaties, which returned the Panama Canal to Panama.
Where Buckley and George Will were on the other side.
Exactly right. So in that case, he was arguing against his friend Buckley and with the more populist right. And one of his seconds actually in that debate was Patrick Buchanan, kind of the leader of the populist right for many years. So he had this ability to kind of not only toggle between the two sides, elite, grassroots, populist, but also synthesize them. And when he comes into power in 1981, he's bringing all these elements of the coalition with him, from the movement conservatives like Buckley to the neoconservatives, who were primarily defense hawks. Here you can think of the former UN ambassador, Jean Kirkpatrick, to the new right populists, the Phyllis Schlafly types, for example, or even the religious right, Jerry Falwell and the Moral Majority. He was able to encompass all these viewpoints and direct them toward a very successful presidency.
Yeah, I suppose in the late 70s, you could say that where the Panama Canal Treaty fight put him on the side of the populists, his opposition to the Briggs Initiative was something where he sort of separated from this rising new right and Moral Majority, the California Initiative, which looked like it was going to pass, actually, until he came out against it, saying that gays could not be school teachers.
You know, in all these cases, Reagan really did his work. He would really think through these issues and kind of try to arrive at what he thought was a logical conclusion about them. And I'll give you the example of abortion as well, an issue where he famously signed a very liberal bill while liberalizing abortion law in California while he was governor. By the time he's president, and the GOP is becoming a pro-life party, Reagan has really adopted the pro-life cause as his own, even issues a small book called Abortion and the Conscience of the Nation in 1984. And when he kind of announces his views on this subject in the 1970s in a radio commentary he gave, it's a kind of a funny thing to read because, or listen to, because he kind of reasons out his position on the basis that of a case where a mother died in childbirth. And so the baby actually inherited the property. And so he said, well, if a fetus has property rights, then the fetus must be alive, right? And this leads him to his new position. So I think that was the same case with the Panama Canal treaties. He would often get very technical in his relation to these issues, the Riggs Initiative, and then of course even defense issues and tax rates. He really always did the work.
One of the reviews I ran across just in the course of reading was suggesting that there was something sort of groundbreaking in your treatment of race and the acknowledgement that racial bigotry played an important role in the history of U.S. conservatism. Having, you know, I guess I didn't have quite the same reaction when I read it, but I wonder what you think of that.
Well, it's definitely not groundbreaking when compared with most studies of the American right that are written by liberals, which tend to very much focus on the history of race relations and its conservative movement's relationship to the civil rights movement, which, you know, coincided with it. I do think that it's slightly unusual for a self-identified conservative such as myself to talk about the history in such a way that mentions some of the blots on the conservative record. And as I say in the book, I do think that the conservative movement's opposition to the 1964 Civil Rights Act was a mistake. Now, there were different types of opposition to the Civil Rights Act. The opposition of someone like Barry Goldwater, who was active in the Arizona NAACP, who helped desegregate the Senate, who said he would have supported the Voting Rights Act in 1965 had he been in the Senate, kind of missed a term because of his presidential run, but who opposed the 1964 Civil Rights Act and did so on constitutional grounds. That's different than some of the other rhetoric that was coming from the right at the time, which was
constitutional libertarian grounds, right? I mean, he didn't want mm-hmm. the regulation of private.
That's right.
Business yeah, owners, he had some Federalist concerns as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he focused on basically the public accommodation provisions, and he also worried that the law would end in racial quotas in employment and admissions. But then there were other conservatives who were just more cultural in their arguments than bigoted. And so I thought you had to include all of that as well in mm-hmm. history.
And a lot of those, I mean, there were just some significant arguments in the pages of National Review.
Yes. You know, National Review, I don't need to tell you, always kind of saw itself as a platform for the various strands of conservatism, various factions on the right. And that included a fair representation of Southern thinkers, Southern conservatives who defended Jim Crow and segregation on various rationales, including James J. Kilpatrick, the Kilpo, a very prominent Southern journalist, and really National Review's chief political correspondent for many decades. I feel that
he was on the pro-segregation side. I think
he was on the pro-segregation side,
yeah.
Yes.
And then later, of course, he got involved in a lot of other interconservative debates where he was on the pro-choice side of the abortion argument, where, fighting a lot of other conservatives.
That's an interesting note. Yeah. I should say too, you know, there were a few people who were pro-Civil Rights Act and disagreed with National Review's editorial position on the civil rights movement. And these were thinkers mainly associated with the political philosopher Leo Strauss, who thought that the federal government should guarantee civil rights for all Americans. And then, of course, later on, the National Review crowd is joined by the neoconservatives, former Democrats, former liberals, who, in fact, didn't join the right earlier, mainly because of the issue of civil rights. So I tend to think that opposition to the civil rights movement and the civil rights acts actually limited conservatives' appeal rather than expanded it.
The skipping ahead a few decades, it strikes me, particularly when we think about the debates of recent years about the right and within the right, that there is a kind of ahistorical view of the conservative movement and Republican Party circa 2012 as though it was the entire history of conservatism, that conservatism was always like that. And so when people are sometimes sort of dismayed or surprised about the about deviations from libertarian orthodoxy in conservatism, they're measuring it against a baseline of a moment that was actually unusually libertarian for the right. And one thing that people don't, I think, appreciate is the extent to which some of these Trumpian or new right currents in conservatism are, in some ways, a return to a pre-Tea Party, less libertarian conservatism. And I think, frankly, I think some of the new right people themselves don't get that. They think of themselves as being at war with a post-war conservative tradition that they regard as a lot more libertarian than it actually was. I just wonder whether you think that there's something to this rambling point that I'm making.
No, I do. I want to spend a little bit of time on the 2012 election, because I think you're right that it was an inflection point and has kind of conditioned the way that many on the populist side of the equation view the Republican Party and conservative politics. One, there's that sense that the Romney-Ryan ticket in 2012 really ran on the economy alone. They didn't really stress the social issues all that much. And that Romney thought that the economy and the slow recovery from the Great Recession would be the path to the White House. What he didn't really realize was that, you know, voters tend to basically cast their ballots on the basis of the direction of the economy, right? And in this case, the economy was recovering. So, you know, a lot of people were like, well, the economy is recovering and Mitt Romney reminds me of my boss and I don't like my boss. So that was, I think, a mistake. The second thing was, you're right to say that the moment at that time, 2009, with the birth of the Tea Party movement, 2012, spent a lot of time talking about essentially austerity, entitlement reform in the form of Paul Ryan's roadmap to America's future, a real coming to terms with the future of America's entitlement state. And that would be on the more libertarian or less socially conservative side. And then the third thing, though, and I think this is responsible for a lot of the way that the populist right views 2012, is they didn't think that Mitt Romney was a fighter. That became really the buzzword on the populist right over the last decade. The populist right wants someone who fights, and Mitt Romney didn't fight. He was kind of beleaguered by the media. you know, when they would write stories about his dog on the car, or they would follow him around Europe and the Middle East and say, you know, what about your gaffes? And then in the debate with Obama, the second debate, there came a moment where basically the moderator, Candy Crowley, took President Obama's side in a factual dispute over how President Obama responded to the attack on the American consulate in Benghazi, Libya on September 11, 2012. And Romney didn't challenge the moderator's assertion. And this became a real sticking point on the populist right. They felt that they needed a champion who would have told that moderator, no, you're wrong, you know, get out of the way. And so 2012 became, I think, the beginning of this search for a fighter on the part of the populist grassroots. And they found one a few years later when Donald Trump arrived on the scene. Many of the more Tea Party-ish elements, not entirely supportive of Trump at first, somewhat skeptical of his positions, but then when he wins the nomination, they come on to his side, and they have not left it since.
Yeah, they come onto his side when he wins the nomination, and then some more when he wins the general election, and then some more when he largely sticks with their positions as president, which, you know, a lot of people had some serious doubts about whether he was going to do that or not. What is it, you know, I've been saying new right a couple times here, just because, you know, there is this group now that incorporates a variety of different perspectives, but that all have in common the idea of breaking with the kind of limited government conservatism of the post-war years. And they're often called the New Right. But the funny thing is, of course, there was another group called the New Right in the late 1970s, which had some resemblance to that. Is it too early to say what the reception of your book on the New Right has been? How are they greeting it?
I think it depends on what segment of this New Right you're talking about. The elements of this New Right, which are actually rather old, which kind of trace their origins back to the Pat Buchanan campaigns of the 1990s. They're not fans of the book, which, you know, was understandable because I'm not a Buchanan supporter, and I make that known in the book. There are the other more nationalist conservatives, the NatCons. They've told me that they think it's a fair portrayal of their views and their history. I try in the book to be as detached as possible. And it's only really at the beginning and the end where I let my own views come out into the open. What was important to me was telling the story and kind of establishing a base of knowledge that now other people can argue about. Because, as you mentioned, Ramesh, I find that so many young Americans in general, but young American conservatives in particular, don't actually know the history of the conservative movement or of the Republican Party. And one of the reasons I wrote the book was to have a text that I or other teachers could just kind of shove into their hands and say, here, read this. This is the story that you're inheriting. I mean, it is odd to me that a conservative in America would not seek to understand the history that they're a part of, that they're trying to conserve. But I think that says a lot about changes in our media culture, and also kind of the ascendance of the populist strain on the right. Populism not necessarily all that attentive to history, actually, but more concerned with exerting the will of the people as soon as possible.
Well, there is, of course, if not a full-blown history, at least a story that a lot of populists tell, in which an older and more classically liberal version of conservatism, it just was a failure, right? Just didn't win many of the fights that it engaged in. And the way this often gets phrased is, what did this conservatism conserve? And are they right? Is that your reading of the history?
It is not my reading of the history. I think a couple of things. One, it's very hard to prove a negative. So there are many, many ways in which America could have taken a more leftward direction, which the conservative movement prevented over time. The power of saying no is an important one. And there are plenty of bad ideas to which conservatives said no. The second thing is, we have to begin with our starting point. That is to say, you know, by what standard are we judging conservative successes? Have conservatives been, you know, all that successful since, say, 2012? Now, that's kind of hard to say. There have been pluses and minuses. But if we go back, though, to the middle of the 20th century, I think the record has been a successful one. I really do. Considering where the conservative movement started from. We have to remember that at the end of World War II, as I say in the book, conservatism was on the fringes of American political and intellectual life. It was not, in 1950, considered mainstream at all to identify as an American conservative. A lot of work had to be done to bring conservatives into the conversation. And then think about the issue that really animated the American right for much of my story. And that is the issue of the Soviet Union and world communism. Well, we still have problems with Russia, as it's plain to see, but the Soviet Union no longer exists. And world communism no longer exists. There are still communist states, but the idea of an ideology on the march that actually claims the sympathies of millions of people within Western democracies, that is no longer the case. That is a tremendous success. I look at the journey of the conservative legal movement, beginning with criticisms of the Warren Court in the 1950s and 1960s, moving to the development of the doctrine of originalism, constitutional jurisprudence, the foundation of the Federalist Society in 1982 as a professional network for originalist lawyers. And then again, with setbacks and successes, culminating in Trump's three appointments to the Supreme Court and the potential for reversal of Roe v. Wade by the end of this term would be a huge success for the conservative legal movement. One other example, I look at the welfare reform of 1996 as in many ways the consolidation of the Reagan approach to government and the implementation of ideas that conservatives had been discussing for decades, most famously in the work of Charles Murray in his book, Losing Ground, published in 1984, but then also involving the work of scholars such as Robert Rector, James Q. Wilson, and others. Great success was achieved there with the end to the way that welfare had been administered in this country and the imposition of a set of limits and conditions that have been quite successful empirically in lowering welfare rolls and actually helping to reduce poverty. So I think the critics of the conservative movement who say it hasn't conserved anything, I think they have a romantic idea of what was possible and also a very nostalgic view of history. Including the idea that they can somehow arrest history and freeze all change. I think a conservative understands that that's not possible. And what's important is how we deal with the change.
The means of change is without the means of its conservation, as Burke said.
Yes, it's like, yes, the very, you know, if it comes from Burke, it must be good, right? Just from a conservative point of view, right? Exactly. And so we have to improve what needs improvement, but we also need to preserve what is good. And I actually think the record can't be denied. And if you want to, if you want any proof, just ask American liberals who think that conservatives are winning, right? As much as conservatives think that conservatives are losing, American liberals seem convinced that conservatives are winning. One other issue too, organized labor, you know, which was a huge issue for the American right beginning in the New Deal era. Of course, labor in the private sector is greatly reduced in the American economy. And the Janus decision by the Supreme Court a few terms ago greatly inhibited even the role of the public sector unions. So there too, I think conservatives can look to success.
Although, you know, of course, interestingly, the, you know, some of the subcategories of the new kinds of conservatism sort of lament the decline of unions as a mediating institution that that used to be, you know, stand between the individual and either the, you know, the global market or the federal state.
Right. And, you know, unions were often allies in the crusade against communism, right. The AFL-CIO in particular. I think what the conservative movement has always stood for is the right to work, and then also a criticism of the public sector union, that is the government.
Well, they were with FDR.
Right, exactly. Government shouldn't be bargaining with itself. So, you know, if the new right disagrees with either of those ideas, then they're definitely new.
Right. I was reminded, though, when we were talking about some of those economic issues, of one of Bill Buckley's favorite lines. He loved quoting T.S. Eliot on there are no lost causes because there are no gained causes. And that has struck me watching some of the economic debates play out right now, whereas I would have thought that in the late 70s and 80s, we kind of killed the idea that corporate greed is the explanation for inflation and we need price controls. And we come up with a much sounder view about monetary restraint being key to it. But nope, here we are, you know, and we should have known because Biden did say Milton Friedman's not in charge anymore. That was probably the cue for inflation to come roaring.
Right.
Back.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, even on tax rates, for example, I mean, if you think about the Biden tax proposal, it's not going back to the era of 70%, 90% top marginal tax rates. And in fact, he even limits the tax increases he's proposing to households making more than $400,000 a year. So the idea that somehow the tax burden should not hit the middle class, which was a very Reaganite idea and kind of part of the supply side economics that Reagan brought to power, that is still very powerful 40 years after Reagan's election.
Yeah. It is probably now about time we should open it up for questions, although there are a lot more that I could ask you. I will just, I will ask my own questions to you next time I see you at the office. But in the meantime, I will look for, look through some of the questions that have been submitted in our Q&A. And I actually, the very first one I see is one that I did want to ask. Which is about nationalism, the place of nationalism within conservatism. The questioner is asking about the militant and exclusive nationalism of today and how it fits into the long arc of U.S. conservative thought. But you know, there's been a range of opinion among conservatives on whether nationalism of any kind makes sense. You know, William F. Buckley, I guess apocryphally said that he didn't have a nationalist bone in his body. I've never been able to track down that quote to see what exactly he meant by it. What do you think?
Well, it is interesting that right has often identified itself as nationalist, especially against what in the New Deal at World War II era was called the One Worlders. The McCarthyites, the supporters of Joe McCarthy in the 1950s, actually referred to themselves as nationalists. And then there were other conservative thinkers, including the British conservative, who was very influential among traditional American thinkers, Roger Scruton, said that nationalism was a part of conservatism, part of the right. So a lot depends on what we mean by nationalism. Is it, as the questioner says, kind of an exclusive blood and soil nationalism? That I think is very foreign to, ironically, to the American constitutional tradition. It is much more like a European type blood and soil conservatism and nationalism. Nationalism in the American context has often just meant pride in American nationhood, in American institutions, in the English language, in American power, and also in Americans' freedom of maneuver on the world scene. So conservatives and the right have been very skeptical of international organizations, whether it was the League of Nations at the beginning of my story or the United Nations for much of the rest of it. Then the question is, you know, what form does that nationalism take? And in my book, I distinguish between disengaged nationalists who were still nationalistic in their view of America, pride in their country, wanted America to be strong, but they were disengaged from the world. They thought that America was weakened when America involved itself overseas. And after World War II and with the beginning of the Cold War, a new brand of nationalism, engaged nationalism, came to the fore. The idea that, again, American strength, American exceptionalism, but America needed to be involved overseas and engage with the world if it was going to defeat world communism. So since the end of the Cold War, both of these tendencies, disengaged nationalism and engaged nationalism, had been fighting within the Republican Party, within the conservative movement. I'd say at the moment, the disengaged nationalists have a slight advantage.
Right. Although with an asterisk, right? I mean, as given the pretty broad support among conservative voters for at least assistance to Ukraine.
Yeah, assistance being the key, because I think it'd be hard to do much more. But the assistance seems to be doing the job at the moment.
Right. But it is controversial on the right, and maybe increasingly so. I mean, there are people who sort of, you know, didn't want to be there in favor of it, and then sort of felt they had to come along, and now more recently seem like they're reverting back to their initial opposition. And I think also it was there was a kind of conservatism that thought of the Cold War as an exception, you know, because you had this incredible, you had a worldwide threat to American interests that also thought of itself as revolutionary, left-wing, and atheist, that you had people like Patrick Buchanan and Phyllis Schlafly, who were sort of natural isolationists, who sort of said, well, not this time. But as soon as it was over, both of them basically thought, well, we don't have to be in favor of this kind of engagement anymore.
Right. And then the right begins looking in some ways like that pre-Cold War right. So in some ways, the Cold War was something of an exception.
So I think, one doesn't want to paint with too broad a brush here. Here I'm sort of riffing off of another question that has come in. But it does seem to me that the rise of populism on the right has at least coincided with a return and a really kind of flowering of conspiratorial thinking on the right. Now, this definitely has a history within conservatism, but I'm not sure it ever has reached the heights that it has in recent years, where, for example, I think President Trump's winning the Republican nomination owed something to his embrace of a conspiracy theory about President Obama's birth certificate, for example. Is this somehow sort of naturally part of the populist package? Is there a way to do what previous eras of conservatives did and beat some of that conspiratorial thinking back?
I do think that when you study the long history of American populism, you see that conspiracy theories often accompany it. And then it's the issue is, do they dominate it? And I think that populism can be positively charged and it can be negatively charged. So much depends on the leadership. So if I look at a figure like Reagan, as we were saying earlier in our conversation, he definitely had ties to the populist wing of the right. And in fact, in his own worldview, really trusted the decisions of ordinary men and women, as opposed to, as he often put it, an out of touch elite in a far off capital, right? And yet he did not succumb to conspiracy theories. He did not promote conspiracy theories. He denounced racism and white supremacy in his famous speech to the National Association of Evangelicals in 1982. And you know, leaders, they define the alternatives, they set the agenda, and they also provide an example to their followers. And so I do think the difference between a Reagan and a Trump is the difference between a populism that is more agenda oriented and forward looking, and a populism that is more conspiratorial and also more susceptible to kind of demagoguery.
Right. I'm going to take a excuse me for that.
Sorry about that.
No problem. Another question that has come in, and I think I'll just read this one verbatim. Do you feel like modern conservatives, especially the younger ones you mentioned, who seem to have no substantial knowledge of their own history, actually want a critical look at their movement's past? Do you in any way feel like they'd see any criticism of this history, like the conservative opposition to the Civil Rights Act of 64, for example, as akin to CRT, even if it comes from a conservative source that is critical race theory?
I hope not.
Which we've seen, you know, does get the phrase does get applied rather permissively.
Oh boy, yeah, it does. It does. I find that in my teaching and in my mentoring of young people, there is a desire to learn more about the past. There's a search for sources that can provide them some insight into the past. Whether they were able to take criticism, you know, what's the word about college campuses? They have snowflakes, you know. I thought that conservatives aren't kind of sensitive snowflakes, that they're able to have a more hard-edged, tough-minded, realistic view of the world. Certainly that's the type of conservatism I identify with. You know, the choice is really up to them, but these are the facts. And look, there are a lot of, in my view, blots on the record of the American left and a turn toward radicalism on the part of the American left, specifically in the late 1960s, early 1970s, which in my view is part of the reason that the American electorate shifted right and eventually elected Ronald Reagan. So if I were a conservative, I would be very worried. If I am a conservative, and I'm worried about repeating the mistakes that the left made in the late 1960s and early 1970s by going too far, by embracing an extremist politics. The American people do not like extremes. I think this is clear. They don't like extremes of personality, which is why they didn't reelect Donald Trump. They also don't like ideological extremes, which is why they seem to be holding a very negative view of President Biden's attempts to be FDR and LBJ and Barack Obama all in one package.
I was talking earlier about some of the parallels between our day and the 1970s, but I wonder if this and could end up being one of those times of a flux on the right that is sort of akin to what happened in the 70s, where sort of we look back and we think, you know, sort of there's a kind of logical progression to the events. But, you know, Reagan could have made different choices, or somebody else could have taken that kind of role and made different choices. But it does strike me that it was also a moment of ferment on the right, and it was also a moment of uncertain leadership at the top. And it's interesting that we had these three one term or less presidents, right? I mean, sort of Nixon's aborted second term, you have Ford's partial term, and then you have Carter's one term. And we just went through a period where we had a bunch of 8-year terms, an unusually long period of 8-year terms. But then maybe Trump and with Biden, we're back in that kind of 1970s experience again.
Yes. Yeah. I think there's something to that. And, you know, also what your point about contingency is very important too. You know, Reagan's career could have ended in 1976. In 1976, he challenges that sitting Republican president, Gerald Ford, for the nomination of the Republican Party. Reagan loses most of the opening contests. His campaign is on the floor. And it's not until the North Carolina primary and the work done by Senator Jesse Helms that Reagan wins in North Carolina and is able to resuscitate his campaign and fight all the way to the convention floor. If North Carolina hadn't gone for Reagan, there might have been no President Reagan.
Right.
What
if he'd won in 1976? That
right.
You know, then maybe he loses. He seems too extreme. The party decides, well, that's not the path we want to take.
Yeah, I mean, you can do that. You can also do that counterfactual. I happen to think he would have been successful in 1976 anyway. But you know, it would have been a very different history, right? I mean, also the Soviet Union may have been in a different place as well. Though, you know, the Soviets, you know, Reagan famously didn't meet with any of his Soviet counterparts during his first term. And one day, you know, Sam Donaldson shouted from the bushes, you know, Reagan, why don't you meet with any of these Soviet leaders? And Reagan shot back, they keep dying on me, you know. But he was trying to wait, I think, until a more amenable leadership showed up in Moscow. And eventually it did, in the person of Mikhail Gorbachev. So yeah, we can play these counterfactuals. And I think the reason we do is because there's that randomness or contingency to history. We just really don't know. I mean, think about what 40,000 votes in three states in 2016 changed the world, right? I mean, if Donald Trump won a sizable electoral college victory, but it was also a narrow one in the actual vote count, and of course he lost the popular vote.
Yeah, and then an even smaller number in 2020.
In 2020, right, could have reelected him, right? So these things are very touch and go. And trying to get that sense into the history, I think, is a challenge for any historian.
So looking forward, even though you're a historian, do you see any weaknesses in the populist streak that could be its undoing, or do you think, you know, at least for the next few years, it is just going to continue to be in the ascendant?
Well, you and I speak on the evening of the Pennsylvania primary, where the contest seems to be between the MAGA candidate, Dr. Oz, and Trump endorsed, and the ultra MAGA candidate, Kathy Barnett, who is not Trump endorsed and who says that the MAGA movement is greater than Trump. So there you really have the fight happening on the populist side. The more movement conservative candidate, who also says he's MAGA, the David McCormick, a former Bush official, he's in the mix as well, but he seems to be trailing. So you can also look at the recent primary in Ohio, where J.D. Vance won a narrow victory. But he was Trump endorsed.
Our former AEM colleague.
Our former colleague,
yeah.
But who is now really the most prominent political spokesman for the new right position that we've been discussing. He has, of course, the edge in the Senate race in Ohio, which is increasingly red. I do think that the populist moment has not ended. I do think the Trump era has not ended. And so the right needs to think of itself more and more as a coalition. And constitutional conservatives, movement conservatives, also need to recognize that they are not necessarily in the same position of leadership or influence that they were even 10 years ago.
Did anything particularly surprise you in researching the history of American conservatism?
I was really drawn to the character of Robert Taft, who I may have mentioned earlier. He was known as Mr. Republican. He was the son of William Howard Taft. He was elected to the Senate from Ohio in 1938. He was a critic of the New Deal, a critic of American involvement in World War II, but had an idiosyncratic political portfolio, ran unsuccessfully as kind of the representative of the pre-World War II right for president and for the Republican nomination. He didn't get it. But a very interesting figure, and I enjoyed reading and researching and writing about him. It also surprised me, in all honesty, how much I wrote about Patrick Buchanan, the commentator and presidential candidate. He shows up in my story in 1965 when he meets Richard Nixon and becomes an aide to Richard Nixon. In fact, Nixon's liaison to what were called the Buckleyites, the National Review conservatives. And he plays a role working for Nixon in the White House, for Reagan in 1986, running for president in the 1990s. And in those presidential candidacies, in many ways, laying the ideological framework that would come to be known as Trumpism. So I'd say I was a little bit surprised at how big a role Pat Buchanan played in the history of the right, though in now, as I think about it, it actually makes quite a good deal of sense.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose there's a way in which Trumpism is kind of Buchananism minus a little bit of religion and plus support for Israel.
That's right, yes.
He didn't go down that particular cul-de-sac.
And you know, it was very savvy. It was, I think it is evidence of Trump's political shrewdness that he understood that hostility to Israel would deny him entree into one of the most important Republican constituencies, the evangelical community.
He was pretty savvy about a lot of those touchstones on the right. He knew the things that he could deviate from the pre-Trump orthodoxy on, and things that he couldn't. And I think you'd have to say that the selection of issues where he could move and where he couldn't, he was pretty savvy.
Yeah, I think that's right. And good at coalition management, which might be odd considering how disorganized his White House was. But Trump always pays attention to his base, as we can even see in kind of his positioning on vaccines for COVID, right? I mean, he's kind of dropped that arrow from his repertoire. His rhetorical repertoire. And also, you know, in outsourcing a lot of policy to even more traditional movement conservatives. So the judges go to the Federalist Society, the tax plan goes to the supply siders, the guns, he's firmly on the side of the National Rifle Association. He was very good at managing the right.
Yeah.
He was not so good at appealing to the center, and that's what cost him a second term.
Yeah. Well, and when he did, you're right. So there were about 5 minutes where he broke with the NRA, if you remember, and then his team sort of reined him back in.
Over the Manchin Toomey gun background check bill. Yeah. And then, yeah.
That was all weapons. Yeah. He told Pelosi and Feinstein. Well, anyway, the story of the Trump White House is a universe in itself, I suppose. Right. And maybe that will have to be your next book. But in the meantime, I would like to thank you for joining us for this conversation, and thank the Free Library for hosting it. Thank you, our audience, for participating and sending in some great questions. And good night to everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.